Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoyed the program. Hi there, and thanks for joining us on Sunday night. It's good to be with you around Australia. Tell me, should religious organisations be free to discriminate against individuals, even on a limited basis? Hi there, good to be with you. Well, it's one of the questions that continue to bedevil the government's attempts to consolidate various elements of anti-discrimination legislation. Religion seems to be feeling much of the heat. The issue has been before a Senate inquiry. The initiating Attorney General, Nicola Roxon, came under some pressure over the matter before her announced resignation. And now the issue has passed to her successor, Mark Dreyfus. It's a somewhat different feeling to the way the issue is being handled in Canada at the moment, where the Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, this week, to much fanfare, announced the establishment of an Office of Religious Freedom. Are there limits to freedom of religion? To what extent, for example, should a religion be free to discriminate on the basis of belief and practice regarding the selection of teachers for its schools? Or should faith traditions rather be setting an example of non-discriminatory behaviour as a model to the rest of society? Well, shortly we shall be joined by Father Frank Brennan, the Reverend Eleni Poulos and Bishop John McIntyre to have a chat about what's at stake and to take your calls on the issue on 1300 800 222. That's 1300 800 222. If you're in South Australia or the Northern Territory, you may wish to give us a ring right now. The rest of the country, just hang on for a while. And tonight, if you're in the USA, well, in just a few hours, will be Oscars night. And we're giving our second hour over to a look at some worthy contenders here on Sunday night on ABC Radio. Tim Cronin of Eureka Street magazine will join us. And we'll then take a close look at the religion of the subject of one particular film, Lincoln. And then we shall be joined by leading historian of religion in the USA, Mark Knoll, professor of history at Notre Dame University in Indiana. But to begin a busy night, we must first turn our attention to the big international story of the week, a story that seems to just keep on giving. The continuing fallout from the resignation of Pope Benedict. Paul Collins, former host here on Sunday night, is soon to be off to Rome to cover the election of Benedict's successor for the ABC. And whilst packing his bags, he has a moment to bring us up to date on the events of the last couple of days. Paul, thanks so much for joining us.
Hello, John.
Paul, we were going to speak to you about one story only, but in the last 24 hours, two more stories have surfaced. What is this about a Vatican cadre of gay cardinals?
Well, I'm not too certain that we're dealing with gay cardinals. What we're dealing with is a report that was handed to the Pope by a commission of three very aged cardinals following the VatiLeaks scandal. And La Repubblica, the rather respectable but nevertheless left-leaning daily newspaper in Italy, is saying that leaked information from that report says that there is a cadre of gay men, specifically priests mainly, working for the Vatican. Now, I mean, anyone who knows Rome knows that there are gay priests around, and not all of them working for the Vatican, let me tell you, and that they have been seen in the various gay beats around the city. So, I mean, that's not telling any tales out of school. It's very well known to anyone who knows Rome reasonably well.
But there are cardinals who are part of this this group, to use a more general term.
Well, that, yes, but specifically who these cardinals are is simply not been nominated. But what I think is really happening here is that this is just, if you like, one aspect of a much more toxic situation that has developed particularly among the Italian cardinals. I mean, daggers are absolutely drawn among the cardinals at the present moment. And I think that this kind of a scandal is—it's kind of in a way very Italian to begin with. I suppose it's English as well, but essentially it's a very Italian kind of scandal. And I think it is a symptom of a much deeper malaise. It's a symptom of the deeper malaise of Catholic and more generally Christian attitudes towards sexuality. But more deeply, more politically, it's about the knives are out as to who's going to get nomination, who's going to get votes, and who the parties are among the Italians.
Well, if we're talking about parties, are we talking about traditional progressive versus conservative forces or factions here, or is this something else?
No, it's something else. It's nothing to do with progressives or conservatives. It's really to do with whether you are, I suppose the essence of the issue is whether you are a supporter of Cardinal Tarcisio Bertone, the present Secretary of State to Benedict XVI, or whether you are a supporter of Cardinal Angelo Sodano, who is the Dean of the College of Cardinals, and he and Bertone are, without any doubt, very, very antagonistic toward each other. So this is a very internal Italian, even Vatican squabble.
Will it have any impact on the gathering conclave?
Well, I think it'll make it much more difficult for the Italians to get their act together, to get an Italian up if they want one. I just think that that this is about a whole lot of manoeuvring. That it's the kind of manoeuvring that you do tend to see before conclaves. It's much more public now than it used to be in the old days, because of course we've got modern media to report all of these things.
Well, but I think if we're talking about manoeuvring, there was a veritable hand grenade launched from Scotland this week in the last couple of days when Cardinal Keith O'Brien, Britain's most senior Catholic cleric, called for married priests, suggesting the practice of celibacy is not of divine origin. Now, it's not just a few months ago that the good Bishop of Toowoomba, Bill Morris, was sacked for daring to suggest that someday somebody might want to have a conversation about this sort of thing.
Yes, well, of course, Bill Morris said it at the wrong time. He said it in the middle of the papacy. Cardinal Keith O'Brien is saying it at the after the announcement of the resignation of the papacy.
But it's a deliberately provocative act on his part.
There's no doubt about that. This is not the first time that O'Brien has said this. He actually said it about 4 or 5 years ago, but was forced to back down by the powers that be. And he said, well, of course, that's not what I really meant, when he clearly did mean it. I think that he's making his presence felt by voicing what many, many people in the pews in the Catholic Church, and certainly what many, many priests in the English-speaking world, including Scotland, where he comes from, he's the Archbishop of St Andrews in Edinburgh. He's just voicing what the simple reality is on the ground among most priests in the English-speaking world, including Australia.
Of course, it's become a bit problematic for him because he's known for his anti-gay views, yet the very day he makes this suggestion, news breaks that 4 men, 3 priests and 1 former priest, have made allegations of inappropriate behaviour against him, stretching back some 33 years.
Yes, I read that in The Guardian today, and I must admit I'm still trying to, kind of get my balance back. I have no idea what the origin of this is, whether it is true or false. It certainly has some possible ring of truth about it, but what they might mean by inappropriate behaviour is anybody's guess. Mm-hmm. So it could be some nasty work to undermine O'Brien. It could be quite true. Here in Australia, I don't think we're in any position to make a judgment about that.
What was his intent, do you think, with regard to the conclave?
I think he's just trying to get the issue on the agenda. Right. He also said that he favoured the election of a cardinal from the developing world. I think that a number of cardinals are trying to get that very much on the agenda. They want to try to counter the attempt of the Italians to kind of get hold of the conclave. They've been kind of trying to do this by moving the date forward.
Well, that takes us to the very issue that you and I were going to discuss, that your suggestion that, in fact, Benedict is seriously considering bringing the conclave forward.
Well, you see, nobody can change the rules once Benedict resigns. The only way that the rules for the conclave can be changed is if Benedict does it before he resigns. I think it's a reasonable possibility. In fact, I've moved my own departure for Rome forward by 4 days because I think it's a reasonable possibility that the conclave will begin not on the 15th but on the 10th of March, which will give them a clear 2 weeks before Easter.
Into whose hands would this play?
Oh, the Italians, without any doubt, particularly the Curial Cardinals, because they are the ones who, despite, and this kind of seemingly contradicts what I've said earlier, but I think, in fact, it's still true, they're the ones who will have at least got their horses into line. They will have been doing some horse trading already, and they will have got their candidates into line. That doesn't mean that they're going to agree on those candidates, but at least they will have prepared. And they're trying to steal a march, I think, on the other cardinals, who have still got to get to know each other. I mean, a lot of these blokes don't know each other. They come from all over the world. And so they need the full fortnight to be able to sort things out. I think the compromise, I think if Benedict allows it, and he might or he might not, it was expected that it would come out on the Feast of the Chair of St. Peter, which was Friday, our time, didn't happen. So if it does happen, I think they will elect to go to run on to start the conclave on the 10th. If nothing happens, they have to start between the 15th and the 20th, and I think the 15th would be the date.
And Bertone and Sedano are the fixers.
Well, Sedano, of course, is not in the conclave because he's over 80. Bertone is, but the antagonism toward Bertone is palpable. He's a mate of Benedict XVI. He worked in the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith with him. In fact, all of the letters except one that I ever received from the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith were signed by Bertone as the secretary. The final one came from Ratzinger himself. And Benedict is very, it's like Labour mates a bit. He's very loyal to his mates. And there's great resentment to Bertone and the Curia, especially among those trained in the diplomatic corps, of whom Sedano is, of course, the leader of those.
Paul Collins is going to be much to report over the next few weeks. We look forward to hearing more of you. And, of course, it comes at a time of some relief for you because just this week you've had a book released in the United States, a new book, The Birth of the West. This is no small ask.
Well, one great sensible thing about people in the 10th century, which is the book is about Europe in the 10th century. Well, in the papacy of the 10th century, John, they didn't muck around. Any pope that got in the way, they put him in the Castel San Angelo and they either strangled him or smothered him, and that was a way of solving the problem.
Okay, let's not take too many examples from the past. Paul Collins, we can get the book on your local internet bookstore, I gather.
That's correct. Or you can even get it from me if you look up my webpage.
Paul Collins, thanks so much for joining us. We look forward to hearing from you over the next couple of weeks, several more times.
Good on you, John.
Thank you. Paul Collins, soon to be the ABC's correspondent on the spot in Rome. You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia. Let's have a little music before we introduce our guests. Here's Diana Krall from her latest album, Glad Rag Doll, When the Curtain Comes Down.
While you are here, if you play fair, you will be welcome up there. When the curtain comes down,
Diana Krall from her album Glad Rag Doll and the song When the Curtain Comes Down. Well, should religious organisations be free to discriminate against individuals even on a limited basis? That's just one of the questions that continue to bedevil the government's attempt to consolidate various elements of anti-discrimination legislation in Australia. And religion seems to be feeling much of the heat. Are there limits to religious freedom? To what extent should a religion be free to discriminate on the basis of belief and practice, for example, regarding the selection of teachers for its schools? Or should faith traditions rather be setting an example of non-discriminatory behaviour as a model to the rest of us? Well, joining us to discuss this issue, it's welcome to John McIntyre, the Anglican Bishop of Gippsland in Victoria, the Reverend Eleni Poulos, National Director of Uniting Justice Australia, and the Reverend Professor Frank Brennan of the Australian Catholic University. Thank you all for being here.
Thanks, John. Good to be here.
Yes. Pleasure.
Good to be here, John.
Eleni, perhaps I could come to you first. For most people, this has been presented in the media rather simplistically as a couple of issues. Should you be free to insult somebody, or should teachers be discriminated against in their employment by religious schools because of their private beliefs? But for you, and I'll ask this of each of you, what is at stake here? Eleni.
Thanks, John. Look, I think what is at stake here is about how we organise ourselves as a society to uphold values of mutual respect, care, the acceptance of the value of diversity, and what makes a healthy society. What this legislation is doing is actually simplifying and filling some gaps in the current Commonwealth legislation, which is a bit of a grab bag of different bits of legislation. This one's trying to bring them all together and trying to cover a few gaps at the same time. I think it's a very worthwhile piece of legislation, needs a bit of work, but really it's part of what we should be doing to look at how we in a very diverse society live together and put some supports in place for people who suffer discrimination.
So you think much of the way it's been handled in the media is a sort of much ado about nothing and stuff?
In one sense it is, because what the government has delivered with this piece of legislation is exactly what they said they would do, which is not to change, for example, the current situation with regards to the exemptions for religious organisations allowed to discriminate. So they've delivered what they said they would. From the Uniting Church perspective, we're actually a little bit disappointed by that in terms of the very broad exception that's given to religious organisations, and we saw this as an opportunity to have a fresh look at that.
So you thought that as a church you shouldn't have the exemptions that you're granted?
The exemptions in previous legislation and in this draft bill are actually very broad, and we believe that it's part of the government's role to balance the different rights in society. So for us, religion is a very important human right and needs to be protected. We're glad that it is strongly protected in this legislation, but it also needs to be balanced against other rights in the very diverse society that we have.
Frank Brennan, the Catholic Church, of which you are a priest, has been rather outspoken on this issue, suggesting that there are things that do need strengthening. What for you is at stake in this legislation?
Well, let me first of all set a slightly different context from what Eleni has put there, in that I live in Canberra. We're dealing with a government at the moment which is, to put it bluntly, in its death throes. All you've got to do is look at the very incendiary dissenting report by the coalition senators in the Legal and Constitutional report that was published on this bill last week. So we're in a field now where in the past on issues of discrimination we could work in a bipartisan sort of way, and it's now in a very toxic mix. Now, part of that toxic mix is that on the one hand, government said, well, all we're going to do is basically consolidate 5 existing pieces of legislation. But then on the other hand, they said, well, we're going to do a few extra things, as Eleni has put it, plugging some gaps. But for conservative lawyers, for example, things like interfering with freedom of speech or reversing the onus of proof, those sorts of things send a clarion call that there's fundamental change at hand. So that's the context. When we come to religious freedom, I think in terms of the Catholic Church's response, there's been a tendency to distinguish what we do in the area of health and welfare on the one hand and education on the other. So if I might just deal with each of those. Welfare, basically the Catholic Church, I think like all churches, says we don't want to discriminate in any way in terms of employment or in the delivery of services. Similarly with health, with a couple of small exceptions, don't want to discriminate in terms of employment, but when it comes to things like aged care services, there have been a couple of issues the church has raised. and I must say I think they're pretty reasonable. One, for example, is where the Catholic Church, unlike the Uniting Church, for example, that Eleni comes from, runs some small nursing homes for retired Catholic nuns. Now, to have the state intervening to say blokes should be allowed in, I think it's a bit rich. Similarly, where we do run some homes for homeless alcoholics, and they happen to be men. Now, to say you should have women there present as well can create significant problems in terms of running those sorts of facilities. The other thing is where you've got Catholic aged care facilities, where you might have a small facility, where you've got couples in their 80s and 90s, and they're in a home sort of environment, whether or not the owner of the facility should have discretion in determining how couples would be placed. And there's been some dilly-dallying about that. Then we come to the fundamental issue of education. And the question is whether in relation to Catholic schools, not whether you discriminate on the basis of sexuality or whatever, but given that the Catholic Church still has a fairly strict public teaching about sexual relations within the context of marriage, whether or not you'd have the discretion to be able to employ or dismiss teachers who support the legitimate purposes of the school, or whether they publicly oppose those purposes. And so is that best done through the state, or can it be done with some wiggle room for church educational authorities?
That latter one, the issue of schools, also spills into another area that opens up a debate that's, of course, been running since the 60s, when you have voluntary associations being funded by the state. Should those churches, voluntary associations, be subject to the disciplines of the state or the laws of the state? And this particularly comes up time and time again in the issue of education.
Sure, but we're now in a... I mean, we live in a democratic, pluralistic society where taxpayer funds even fund political parties now. But we allow a fair degree of discretion to political parties in terms of who they would employ. And so the question is, what are the legitimate purposes that a church employer might have as an educational facility? And I think that's where we have to try and get some clarity. But as I say, in the present political context, in the past we'd be able to do this in a bipartisan sort of way. The prospect of getting this reasonably worked out before September, I think pigs will fly.
Yeah, because it's worth too much to keep it in the air. It's too much political
advantage. It'll be a party political issue. And as I say, all you've got to do is look at the incendiary report by the coalition senators in last week's report. And so government will have to tread very carefully indeed, lest it become an election-type issue, which would be very unfortunate for everyone.
Now, Reverend John McIntyre, or Bishop John McIntyre, I should say, you're a bishop in the Anglican Church of Australia, and Anglicans operate diocese by diocese. I gather there are a variance of views within the Anglican communion about this issue.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we don't have a what you might call central Anglican teaching about these matters, and so diocese by diocese, we operate in different ways. We have a lot in common, of course, and we discuss things with each other. But in the end, what I'm going to say doesn't necessarily represent anything beyond what I'm saying and what I believe. Mm. And that's part and parcel of the way we operate. But the thing, I guess, the two things that I want to begin by saying is that I'm not absolutely convinced that freedom of religion is threatened in any way by anti-discrimination laws, and I'm not absolutely convinced that the exemptions give us anything. And I guess the other thing is that my concern is that with religious organisations having exemptions from a law that's been put in place to try and emphasise the dignity of every human person, I think it just sends the wrong message to the community about the churches.
So you, in that sense, are arguing a similar position to that advanced by Eleni earlier, that the overall position of religion as exemplars to the rest of the community should override any narrowly perceived need for individual protections.
Yeah, That would certainly be the position that I would take and have taken publicly.
Could I maybe just make a rejoinder to that?
Yeah.
I think probably Eleni, John and I are just about on 100% agreement on what we're discussing, except in this regard. I think in Australia we put too much emphasis just on discrimination legislation. And that's because we do not have a Human Rights Act and because we do not have human rights recognised in our Constitution. I mean, this is, it's falsely described as a human rights and anti-discrimination bill, whereas in fact it's an anti-discrimination bill. I think we're going to have ongoing problems in Australia until the freedom of religion is recognised as a right in our law. Now, while it's treated simply as an exception or an exemption under discrimination legislation, it will be taken to be seen as special pleading, and it'll be taken to be seen not showing sufficient regard for the dignity of others. Whereas what we're trying to do, as we're always doing with human rights jurisprudence, is to balance conflicting rights, one of which is the right to freedom of association and the right to freedom of religious expression.
Yes, I agree with Frank wholeheartedly about the value of a Human Rights Act for Australia. I think one of the great disappointments of recent legislative history is the incapacity of the government to move ahead with a Human Rights Act for Australia. And so you're...
Opposed by many religious groups, incidentally.
Yes, and supported by many others.
Tell me about it.
Look, and Frank is right. As I said earlier, this is a very hard thing for governments to do, but they do have a responsibility to work out how to balance competing rights. And what the Uniting Church is saying is that we understand our place as one institution amongst many in a diverse, secular and multi-faith society, and that we need to have conversations with each other about where we draw the lines in terms of good behaviour. One of the good things that I think has happened with this legislation is that the government has released it as a draft, and that enables all of these conversations to happen. And one would hope then that looking at the opposition, the dissenting report from the committee, and saying it's all too hard, that we might actually continue to have the conversation. That's maybe a little idealistic, but that would be my hope.
John McIntyre.
There, look, I, in many ways, I think I certainly agree with what Frank has just been saying. As I said before, my issue is that with exemptions from an Anti-Discrimination Act, it does, and it is, to a large extent, special pleading. So that we were to have enshrined in law a Human Rights Act, which protected freedom of religion and freedom of conscience, would certainly be a better way forward. The unfortunate reality is that we haven't got that. Though, correct me if I'm wrong, and I may be wrong, I thought freedom of religion was in our Constitution.
Well, it's there in Section 116, but it's very restricted. It can only apply to Commonwealth Act of Parliament, not to a Commonwealth Executive Act. And it doesn't apply to any state laws or any state actions. There was an attempt in 1988 by Sir Maurice Byers' Constitutional Commission to broawden that, and the Hawke government put it forward. And yes, there were significant religious leaders in the country who opposed it. I wasn't one of them. I think Sir Maurice Byers got it dead right, and I think we're suffering the effects of this 25 years on.
Oh, thank you. That explains it very well, Frank. So I'm with you on that human rights front. I think that would be a far better way forward. The problem that we have is because we haven't got it, we now have this, what I see to be, anomalous situation where the churches are given what can only be argued is a special pleading in relation to anti-discrimination.
Yes, but what do we do about the nun's retirement home? Do we do about the home for the homeless alcoholic? I mean, they're practical issues that have been raised by the Catholic Church.
Yeah, but you could ask the same question, what do you do about McRobinson Girls High School, which is a government-run high school where only girls can go? Is it discriminating against boys? And there are certainly independent schools where they are single-gender. I think a bit of common sense has to come into this, and I think that it's clear to me that anti-discrimination laws aren't there to be used by people who, for example, would argue in your case that a male should go to a home for nuns or a boy should go to McRobinson Girls High School.
Sure. Well, Catholic Health Australia put forward what I think was a very reasonable small amendment to cover that, but to date government has said we're not interested. That then politicises the issue.
Yeah, and I agree with your comments about it being politicised. It's a very unfortunate context to be having a discussion of this nature within a situation where we've got an upcoming election and where everything's so on edge.
One of the things that surprised and horrified me most about the exception given to religious organisations in this draft legislation was the inclusion of potential pregnancy. I mean, we talk a lot about others, but to include potential pregnancy in such a piece of legislation is just mind-blowing. I mean, it basically gives carte blanche to religious schools and other bodies to discriminate against a woman of childbearing age. It's outrageous. I don't know why it's still there, and I was surprised that the committee hadn't recommended its removal.
It's totally contrary to gospel values, and to have government officials drafting legislation of this sort, I think, shows how out of touch they are.
Can I ask a couple of specific questions? Incidentally, if you'd like to join this conversation, 1300 800 222. You can 1300 800 222 to join Frank Brennan, Eleni Poulos, and John McIntyre talking about the anti-discrimination legislation or the possibilities of in Australia, and the new heat that's been injected into the argument over recent days with Nicola Roxon moving on, a Senate inquiry having expressed a few views, and a new Attorney General, Mark Dreyfus, reviewing the situation. 1300 800 222 is the number to call. Let me ask a couple of specific questions, get them out of the way. Earlier on, it was mentioned about the Frank Brennan, I think you mentioned it, the reverse onus of proof. Now, this George Brandis of the Liberal Party made much of this from a very high sounding legal argument. Did he have a point?
I think he's got a point. I think he's overplayed it, if I may say so with respect, but I think my more fundamental concern, rather than lining up on the party politics of this, John, is to say that this sort of legislation in the past, we've been able to work in a more bipartisan sort of way. Now, where you had this brought forward as a draft of legislation, you even had senior ministers like Simon Crean trying to appease people who are opposed to provisions in it, saying, look, no problems, all we're doing is replicating exactly what was there. Well, they weren't doing that. Now, whatever the pros and cons of reversing onus of proof or whatever, when you have it out there that, look, all we're doing is replicating what's already there, put that into the toxic political mix that we have at the moment. I mean, if the community is to move forward, because it's always said with this sort of legislation that you want it to have a profound educative effect, the last thing you want it to do is to become party political in this sort of way.
Yes, but you can see why it is. It has become party political. Do you think, Eleni and John, that just on the George Brandis thing, that that he had a point? That there was a...
The reversal of the onus of proof, I think it's a very technical argument in the legislation, and you know, the committee has come out and said, look, we think it's all right. I mean, I read their response to that. You know, I'm pretty satisfied with it.
John McIntyre.
Yeah, it is highly technical, isn't it? I think enough. Yeah, look, I I think that what Frank is saying is true. I think it's so politicised that we're losing what the real issues are in these kinds of arguments where people are trying to get on the political front foot.
Well, the other argument that's put forward is an argument that goes back to the nature of voluntary associations, that in a free society, a voluntary association should be free to do anything. It should be able to discriminate. It should be able to make any discriminatory objections at once, provided it doesn't injure others. And it's a voluntary association. Now, there are two aspects to this, the two sub-arguments that come out of it. One, what then is a definition of a voluntary society, or what is the definition of injurious to others in the context of a voluntary society, be that a religious group or other? And secondly, what happens when that voluntary society is in receipt of government funds? Are they then obliged in some way to be responsible for the values or to represent the values of wider society? Eleni?
The Uniting Church has always said that it is willing and happy and thinks it's entirely appropriate for us as a church to be accountable to the wider society. Right? We are well beyond Christendom. And as part of the church, we have to bear some responsibility for the terrors that the church over thousands of years has inflicted upon others. We have been responsible for discrimination and violence and abuse of some of
yes,
the worst
kinds. I was asking a point about voluntary associations in a civil society. Should they be free to set the boundaries of membership or participation? And what are the limits to those boundaries?
Yes. Look, to some degree, yes, they should be. So, and this is one of the reasons why it's important that such legislation includes exemption for the provision of the ordination of leaders of churches.
So you'd set them as broadly as possible in one sense. That is.
Well, what we've said to the government is that we are fully supportive of the exception to the discrimination laws with regards to the training and appointment of ordained ministers and people in significant leadership positions in the organisation. When we as a church get sort of down into sort of more regular kinds of employment, then for us it's actually about the inherent requirements of a role. So if, for example, you have a school principal and part of their role is to lead worship regularly, to pop into religion classes and talk about the faith, that's one thing. If you have a gardener who's working in the grounds, is it an inherent requirement of the role that person be a Christian, or that person live in a married relationship rather than a de facto relationship? From a Uniting Church point of view,
the question of inherent requirement of the role, what is inherent, becomes then the subject, particularly for religious groups. Frank Brennan.
Well, if you look just at the list of attributes that are listed in this proposed legislation regarding ordination, you can see it's been drawn up by people who have no sense at all about what are the prerequisites for ordination in any church. I mean, for God's sake, why would breastfeeding be an issue as to determine whether or not someone's available for ordination? Why would family responsibilities be? Why would potential pregnancy be? Why would pregnancy be? I just think it's a piece of very shoddy drafting.
Mm. I agree with you, Frank.
Yeah, and I think the reality is that in any position that anybody has, really, not just in voluntary organisations, but anywhere, there are certain qualifications, for want of a better term, that are required to be able to do the job. And that, I think, applies to people who are in a whole range of leadership positions within the life of the church, for example. So you can legitimately say that a person, not on the grounds of who they are, but on the grounds of what, and again, I can't think of a better term, what qualifications they have, either can or can't do the job. At one level, whenever you engage somebody in a position of leadership in any organisation or employ somebody in any workplace, there's a level of discriminating that is going on. If you want to say that you're looking for a certain type of person who has certain qualifications and who is able to sustain the ethos or culture of the organisation or even the workplace that you are engaging that person in. So I think there's a level of common sense, really, that says that there is a requirement for a kind of discrimination to any position that you might put anybody in any situation.
John, could I just make a point, a philosophical point, yes, about your observation on voluntary associations? I think one of the big challenges for us as in Australia is, do we work on a sort of bipolar model of individual and the state, or is it a three-way triangle where we have the individual, civil society and the state? The mistake we often make nowadays in discussions of these things is we allied civil society with the state. And what we're looking for is, once we're stepping beyond the bounds of individual privacy, what's the liberty that's allowed to individuals to associate and to determine their course of action without state intervention, even if there be some taxpayer funding? Now, one of the real fears that exists in relation to this area, you mentioned Canada at the beginning with the proposed Office of Religious Freedom. That may be a positive. I know we have a Jesuit high school in Canada at the moment which is suing the government in the Supreme Court there, because the government is wanting to insist that the Jesuit school teach the syllabus of the state-authorised ethics course. Now, the Jesuits are there saying, well, look, we've actually taught ethics for 500 years, and we think we're not bad at doing it, and we don't think the state should be stepping in. Now, I think there is room for legitimate difference about that sort of thing, and that's where we then get back to drawing what are to be the clear lines of discrimination and of religious freedom.
Because there's an one could string that out a little, Frank, and go to the question that was raised some weeks ago in all the hyperbole about whether priests would go to jail over violating the confessional. Oh. That is, there is a point at which the religious organisations themselves will determine, if they feel strongly enough about it, the power of the state.
There are, and I mean, that's a whole other discussion,
yes,
but in straight consequentialist terms, I've been saying for some time, look, I've been a priest for 27 years or something, I've heard quite a number of confessions, and I've never had anyone confess about child abuse, and I'm sure if I did, the particularity that I'd be given would be insufficient to help the police in any way. But putting the consequentialist argument to one side, I simply say, look, I find child abuse absolutely repugnant and terrible. I find acts of terrorism repugnant and terrible. I find murders repugnant and terrible. But if something is confessed to me in confession, I, as a Catholic priest, I'll go to jail if need be, rather than breach the seal of the confessional. Now, there'll be people who don't respect that. Fine. I, at least, will have my dignity in going to jail.
Yes, and some would argue that in a civil society is where boundaries are absolutely, ultimately, reasonably set by people. That is, there is something, there is a line which we will not cross as a religious organisation.
Yes, individually or collectively, there may come a stage where in conscience we say we cannot comply with this particular law. I mean, we have a notion of law which is not just straight positivism. We see that law in some way respects political morality. Ronald Dworkin, one of the great jurisprudential thinkers who died a week ago, often made this point, that law and justice come together.
You're on Sunday nights on ABC Radio around Australia through Radio Australia and via the web to the world. Our guests are the Reverend Eleni Poulos, National Director of Uniting Justice Australia, Bishop John McIntyre, the Anglican Bishop of Gippsland in Victoria, and the Reverend Professor, in this instance, Frank Brennan of Australian Catholic University.
I think I should shut up now. I've been talking to you.
John McIntyre, we're going to take some calls in a moment, but just on this position for you, let me put it to you that with this civil society argument, what about the argument that voluntary associations in a civil society should be free to conduct themselves as they wish until you get to the point where they are engaged in taking money from the state. And at that point, things have to be viewed somewhat differently.
Well, I guess you're suggesting that money is the bottom line, are you, John?
Well, for some people, it may well be.
Even that's not quite as simple as it sounds. For example, it seems to me you take a school that's an Anglican school, in our case, the students who go there and the families who send them are citizens of this country who pay their taxes. And it seems to me that if they want to send their children to an Anglican school because they see that as promoting certain values, and that school is receiving funding from the government, I can't see how that is the final argument that would say, therefore, they have to comply absolutely with everything that the government would demand, to the extent, to use the example that Frank gave of the Canadian situation, that they have to teach ethics in a certain way if it was contrary to what Anglicans believe.
Why not? Their taxpayer money will get them a place at a normal state school. I mean, what they are claiming is to teach a privileged curriculum on the basis of taxpayer funding. Those kids could go to an ordinary school. If they want privileged teaching, they should be prepared to pay for it.
What I'm saying is that if you agree that every child in this country who is a citizen of this country and whose family are citizens of this country are paying taxes, and some of those taxes are used for education, it doesn't seem to me it matters which educational institution they're operating in.
Exactly.
That's the point I'm making, though. I'm disagreeing with what you're saying on the point of what, on the common point. Why would the fact that taxpayer money is going to an Anglican school mean that it should be dictated to by the government as to what it can and can't teach?
Eleni.
John, can I take us back to some first principles? The whole idea of human rights legislation, anti-discrimination legislation, is to get society thinking and talking and setting boundaries around itself for how we relate to groups of people, in order to ensure that groups of people, just by virtue of their membership of a particular group, are not discriminated against, that they have opportunities to make choices in their lives and to lead a flourishing life for themselves. So you, as churches, we are to be concerned about people who are homeless, who are discriminated against. You know, people who live with disabilities and with chronic illnesses, who are discriminated against. This is the first principle of this kind of legislation. And it's actually quite painful to me that we get caught up in a lot of this stuff around, you know, teachers and gardeners and schools and things like that. And we miss the main aim of this legislation, which is to give people in our society dignity. And that's what we should be working together with. And that's why I agree with Frank. It is a travesty when it becomes politicised.
Time to take just a few calls. Sorry for the delay, folks, but now's the time. So we shall say hi to Heather in Nowra first up. Heather, thank you for joining us.
Hi. Yes, first of all, education, perhaps when Jesus said, "Suffer the little children to come unto me," perhaps that young lady might think that education, in fact, is a fairly education in the values and the ethics of Christianity is pretty important to a Christian school, first and foremost. But what I'm actually just phoning to say is that Professor Lachlan Chipman, years ago in 1980s at Wollongong University, taught in human rights. And, well, not necessarily taught, but warned us about becoming a litigious society like America was, and was genuinely pretty much pushed forward by the judges and the lawyers of our own country so that we could, in fact, become a republic. But more than anything, it could fill the coffers of those judges and lawyers if we did become a society where everything was based on law. And it looks like that's what's happening right now.
So you're suggesting that's an argument against the Human Rights Act, are you?
Yes. Absolutely. Because it seems to be going against the values of the... It's challenging Christianity at its core, in a way. You know, we've already got our human rights. It's called the Ten Commandments. We've got it based on the Westminster Abbey, whatever it was. You know, we've got those rights already there. And like Jesus says, unless we give up our rights, you know, we don't have any. We shouldn't have any. We have to give up our rights voluntarily in order for other people to live a happy life, I guess.
Heather, thanks for your call. We'll take that as a comment. We'll go to Rod in Fairfield. Hello, Rod. Welcome.
Hello, John. I just want to say any organisation in Australia receiving taxpayer money should abide by government rules reflecting the wider values, and if they want to teach or do whatever else, they should go it alone financially.
So you're not against them having the ability to do such, you just say they should do it without the government?
Absolutely.
Right. Okay, Rod, we'll take that as a comment too.
Thank you. Bye.
Good on you. All the best. That's Rod in Fairfield to Joseph in Sydney. Hello, Joseph. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you. I put it to you that anybody should be allowed to employ exactly whom they wish. If they're paying them the money or they have the authority to employ somebody, they should have complete say in what they want. They have to live with them and work with them. And even if it's just on personal attractiveness or choice, that should be it. I mean, once you start bringing in discrimination, you'll get people working in places where they're not popular, particularly with authorities, and things will just simply be worse.
You've been on Sunday Night. 1-300-800-222 is the number, and we'll be on this number all evening and take your calls later on. But right now, we've actually run out of time. It barely seems we've got the sort of the discussion started. The Reverend Eleni Poulos, thank you so much for joining us. To Bishop John McIntyre and to Frank Brennan, it's been great to have you with us. Thanks so much for joining us on Sunday Night.
Thank you, John. Thank you, and good night.
Thank you, Frank.
And even though we've only cantered round the turf, folks, we do hope we've stimulated a little of your thinking, and perhaps you can make your feelings known to your politicians as the debate rolls forward during the year. This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. You can download your favourite Sunday Night interviews from our website at abc.net.au/sundaynights with an S. Thank you for listening.